Join Johannes, a necromancer of some little infamy, and his charismatic brother Horst in the many adventures of the Cabal brothers on the Necromancer's Deathcast. From circuses to dreamlands in turn-of-the-century never-never England, author Jonathan L. Howard brings his dry wit and exceptionally clever writing to the series of the most intense and tumultuous proportions. Rise up, all ye undead, and rejoice in the wonder that is the Necromancer's Deathcast. Welcome to the Necromancer's Deathcast, brought to you by Free Flow Rambling. This is episode 3.5, That's Psychology, where we are discussing the book Johannes Cabal, the Necromancer. My name is Tanzin, and I am joined by Amber.
Hi there.
And Jess.
Hello.
Chapter 5. The carnival is in full swing. A couple, Ted and Rachel, are in attendance. Horst and Cabal find a particular interest in Ted due to his unwieldy and brutish behavior. The pair lay a trap for the bullish man. So chapter 5, in which Cabal plays with dolls and Horst broadens his vocabulary.
Ha, ha, ha. Always good intros.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good so titles. Good. So good.
It's a little bit of like that Shakespearean sonnet at the beginning of every play where it's like he gives you the entire story and yet gives nothing away at all.
Totally. Ironic summaries.
Yeah.
So we start off and it's a bit of a description of carnivals in general, just sort of laying the scene and talking about how they are there to amuse and distract, to draw us in.
Mm. Ooh la la.
Ooh la la. I actually really like the line. It is a jolly pickpocket and a charismatic confidence trickster. So,
yeah. And then we get an ominous description of the Cabal Brothers carnival. Behind the wide, welcoming smile was a man-trap baited with desires and delights, pleasures and popcorn, hedonism and hot dogs of dubious content.
Where can I find this place? I want to go there.
Right?
I want to go there.
I like, too, that it goes on to say, like, but it's okay because everyone comes to the carnival expecting to be ripped off.
Absolutely.
Right? Like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And all that was different here is a scale of loss. I like that.
That's fine. Which, I mean, really, like, here in Canada, we're well aware of Stampede, the greatest show on earth. And that is just, like, a $5 billion day if you go.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
A bottle of water is like $26 and you're like, I need it. I'm dying out here.
And there's nowhere to refill it at all.
Yeah, nope. Buy another $26 bottle of water.
Kind of reminds me of the Comic Expo too, right?
Totally, like, yep.
Yeah, you pretty much have spent $100 before you even walk in the gate.
Yep.
So.
It's just one of those things. Yeah, you go to this sort of an event. Money, money, money.
Yes. Mm. But it's the experiences
that count.
It's the
experience.
It's
yeah.
The experiences.
Yes. Lifelong experiences of empty wallets.
I already had this before I came.
One of my favorite sayings is no one on their deathbed ever wished they'd worked more. But every time I go to the fair, I'm reminded of why I do work. In order to afford such experiences, monumental, life-changing, whatever. And the Cabal Brothers Carnival is definitely life-changing.
Yes.
That's one word for it.
Wah, wah, wah.
So we meet Rachel and Ted, or Ted and Rachel.
Yes. Ted and Rachel.
And we quickly realize that Ted is an abusive fuckhead.
Right?
Sure is.
Yes, of Rachel. It wasn't a very convincing smile, but it showed sufficient compliance for Ted to uncurl the fist that had unconsciously formed at his side. This is our first introduction to Rachel, and I think it's, the whole very descriptive of her quote-unquote last split lip. So We do indeed find out Ted's a dick.
Yes.
Yep.
So, Ted's gonna die.
trigger warning on the following episode.
Yeah.
We will be discussing spousal abuse, potentially. Yes.
Well, we'll get into it a little bit more as the chapter goes, but I like how JLH wrote Rachel kind of going through these high and lows throughout the chapter. She'd be like, you know, she'd almost start to be like, oh, that's wrong. And then she'd be like, oh, but, you know, it's Ted. We love him and it's fine. And be like, damn, girl.
Totally.
All right. Yeah. Just continue through this chapter as it gets sadder and sadder.
So we get a little bit more of a description of the carnival as well through the eyes of Rachel and Ted. But there's a really funny statement, and I couldn't help but quote this one because it made me laugh. Yes, its true function was to tempt, to contentiousness, to blasphemy, argumentation, and murder. But you could also win coconuts.
I actually noted that too. I think every dark description should end with that. You know?
But you could win coconuts.
But you could win coconuts.
Come to the dark side. We have coconuts.
And then I found $20.
Calliopes and coconuts. All at the Cabal Brothers Carnival.
Put that on the sign.
Great alliteration. But yes.
And the farmer is counting heads, completely oblivious to his ultimate fate.
Absolutely.
It's a poor bugger.
Well, and as he's counting his money, I love that he what is it? Did I quote this? Not knowing he'd signed away his soul for this. This is the quote. If he'd been under the impression that the Ministry of Agriculture was addicted to paperwork, first contact with Arthur Trubshaw would set things in perspective. I laughed out loud. Again, we get back to Arthur Trubshaw. Yes. And he's a recurring character throughout this whole thing where it's like, oh, the forms. Ah, the bureaucracy of hell.
And not forget.
The bureaucracy of hell.
So throughout their somewhat meandering, which again, I like as well that it's like they're in their Sunday best, but it's wrong. Doesn't quite fit, doesn't quite sell it. But yeah. They've dressed up for the carnival.
This is Rachel and Ted.
Rachel and Ted, yes. Yep. Rachel's got lots and lots of makeup on. Too much, one might say.
Right.
And then, as we see, they have a surprise guest. Surprise watcher?
Yes.
A peeping horst?
Peeping horst?
Yes, horse cabal, invisible to all but the most perspicacious of cats or suspicious of dogs, watch them go by. We learn here that Horst has tricks and powers up his sleeve. So he's imperceptible, speed, strength, and mesmerism.
So do you think that this is a legitimate superpower or just kind of... just something he kind of picked up, you know, like, is he really doing something supernatural? Is it just him just kind of like, you know, meld into the shadows and be forgotten, you know?
Isn't it vampire par for the course?
I'm just wondering, like, is this like he's gone supernaturally invisible or is he just gone like supernaturally still and people's eyes just kind of like flip past him, you know, like blends into the background? Or is he legitimately invisible?
What's the story in the vampire... What's the consensus in the vampire world? Is it invisibility or...
Well, there's a lot of different vampire tales, you know?
True.
Twilight, they sparkle.
Oh, thank God Horst doesn't sparkle.
But his charm, like, ultimately he does. So, like, you know, sorry, I'm stretching the metaphor a little bit. But, like, you know, I don't know if he just faded into the background. From the beginning, we're given the impression that Horst is, you know, charismatic. Mm-hmm. He does attract attention.
Well, he's in a purple suit right now.
Right?
Don't forget. Yeah.
So, like, is it, I don't know. I tend to think that the speed would probably, speed and stealth, that's pretty vampire-like, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. I'd agree. I think it's more supernatural than him just sort of, that cloak and dagger sort of.
I just can't see him as a wallflower.
Hmm. Well, I just know, like, in other texts, you know, sometimes, like, any supernatural being just has the ability to, like, stop breathing because they don't need to breathe, right?
Right.
It's just normal for them to, like, pick up the habit when they're around humans and things like that. But, like, every now and again, you know, you'll read a book or something like that. Like, I'm thinking, like, our other podcast, The Dresden Files, Harry always says, like, oh, I don't like it when they stop breathing. Like, it creeps me out when they just suddenly stand still and, like, just stare at me like a monster. Like, it reminds me, like, oh, yeah, they're not human. So right. I'm just thinking like this, like, is Horst fully invisible or is he just, like, that supernatural? Like, I don't actually need to hover and, like, rub my hands and breathe and shift. Like, I can just literally, like, become a statue because it doesn't matter. I don't know. I'm just, just a small curiosity.
Yeah.
Is he really visible or not?
Mm-hmm. We've got another description of the two, which is it's very sad to read. There was a term that was used for Rachel, which is conditioned ambiguity. which I thought was a very clever way of describing her, but very sad ultimately. Mm-hmm. And then we've also got for Ted a figure of uncertain purpose, which ultimately is very, very tragic for both the characters. Like sort of a very florid way of describing them that just makes them sound really pathetic.
Yeah.
True.
Well, it says a little bit later, too, that, yeah, like, Ted just cannot choose between whether or not he wants to show Rachel off or, you know, take out the eyes of everyone who ever looked at her, you know? Like, he's caught between this constant war with himself, like, look, 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 and how dare you look, and just can't even decide for himself which side of the fence he wants to be on.
Well, it's a possessiveness, right? Yeah. It's more about ownership than any actual love or consideration.
He just owns.
She mine.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Horst, whether or not visible or otherwise, at least is very fast. Goes to assault Cabal.
Absolutely.
Sudden appearance, much to everyone's surprise. Oh, he's quite the magician.
Right? I like to, and Cabal's just like, my brother! That was meant to happen.
He brings a drink for Johannes. He takes it and spits it out. It's root beer. Johannes is not impressed.
Speaking of overpriced items at the Stampede, it's definitely one of my favorite items is the root beer. So I laughed out loud at this point when he was saying, after he hands him the root beer, people drink this for non-medicinal reasons? They must be insane.
Which is like, of all the drinks too, like root beer is not that harsh of a drink. Like,
right? Little kids dig it.
I'm just trying to think of like olden day root beer maybe would have been a little bit more.
Like a ginger beer is a little bit more potent with that sort
of. But still, I'm like, come on, man.
Pretty easy. So yes, Cabal puts a 10-year-old boy in charge of the barking to go check on the victim that Horst had identified.
Yeah, and so that description that we have of the boy, so he pulls aside a 10-year-old boy with a Dr. Terwilliger beanie cap, a red and white striped t-shirt, and a bag of freshly roasted peanuts.
So what's a Terwilliger?
The can little any cap with a spinner.
Yeah, but
that is not it.
Oh?
No, I looked it up. And Dr. Terwilliger is a reference to the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, a 1953 American musical fantasy film about a boy who dreams himself into a fantasy world ruled by a diabolical piano teacher enslaving children to practice piano forever.
Sounds like my old teacher.
Yeah, it's the only feature film written by Theodore Seuss Geisel, Dr. Seuss.
Dr. Seuss!
Yeah, who wrote the story, screenplay, and lyrics. Now, I will post this on our website as a post.
Oh.
But the beanie is this blue beanie with a hand with a yellow. It's a yellow hand that's on the top of his head.
It's literally a hand sticking out of the beanie.
Yep.
That's amazing. Wow.
Well, okay then.
Because I thought at first it was the
spinny hat.
Yeah.
So, last episode, I'm not going to be able to explain it as much better now. I couldn't find the words perfectly, but as we were talking after we stopped filming, we were talking about that musical piece, right? And we spoke about that one composer who plays music wrong, but he's, like, fantastic at playing it wrong.
Oh, Victor Borge.
Yes,
Borge. Borge?
Yes,
and Victor Borge. And that was my kind of thing, like, with JLH, like, you have to know the rules before you can break them. And so it's like moments like this, like this normally, like this scene between Cabal and the boys, like, yes, you here, come here, up here, behind this podium. No, perhaps not. Nobody will see you. To the side. Take this ridiculous hat. Now put this ridiculous hat on. There. Now go. Like a lot of the time, like this talk is something that authors will do to try and have like a little bit more realism. Like they'll backtrack like in real life. How if we have a conversation, like, wait, no, that wasn't right. What was I thinking? What's the word? I can't think. Right. But you don't read that in stories because that's not very good for the flow, right? But I find that some authors will try to put that conversation into the stories anyways to give it more realism between characters.
About the authenticity.
But I don't like that because it's like, no, like we actually don't need this. Like just get on with the plot. But I find with JLH, he does a good job of it and it actually is just witty and funny and paints a better picture.
Right.
Whereas normally I find with a lot of authors, they try and throw in this authenticity and it really just falls flat and you're like, okay, like just move on. So a 10-year-old gets a job.
Yeah.
And Horst and Cabal move on.
Totally.
Well, yeah, Horst essentially says, like, listen, I found someone in the carnival that I think should sign a form. And Cabal is like, oh, really? Who? And Horst is like, bye. Not my job.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking that when he sees the penny arcade, like, I actually really enjoyed the description of, like, the wealth redistribution center. Like, having been a longtime student of, like, political theory, I was just like, or political and economic theory. The Marxist tendencies of the, yes. I love the arcade was busy. At the one-armed bandits, a man was consistently losing, while his less well-off neighbor was on a lucky streak, both unaware of the arcade's Marxist tendencies. Yeah.
Johannes is really quite uncertain how to get the carnival into action and decides to listen to his instincts instead of his intellect. He tried to clear his mind, tried to silence the thousand buzzing thoughts that made up his conscience, tried to ignore the sound of the crowd. He concentrated and focused until there was nothing. Nothing at all. Certainly nothing helpful.
See, and that's interesting. Like, he kind of, yeah, when he talks about, like, my first thought when it started talking about, like, Johannes trusting his intuition, it's like, is he intuitive naturally? Like, I think he's more analytical. So, yeah. It's, yeah, a nice little gear shift on us. It's like, wait.
I had that quite a guffaw moment when I read that. Like, nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing at all. Nothing helpful.
Nothing of use in the intuition. Absolutely. Yeah. So, and we see Madame Destiny.
Yeah.
I envision her much like the Madame Destiny from Big. Do you remember that Tom Hanks film?
No.
Oh my God, you're so young.
Hi.
It is such a good movie.
Hello.
Tom Hanks wishes to be Big, and he has to go through, what is it, Zohar? The machine? Anyways, he doesn't have to go through. He puts money into Zohar and it gives him his wish to be Big. So,
and he wakes up as a 30-year-old man the next day.
I've seen 13 going on 30.
It's very similar.
Okay.
Yeah. Similar in principle only. Tom Hanks is the original, damn it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, okay. Freaky Friday back in the 70s, I think, would probably be the original.
That's a little different.
Yeah. I may not have body a clue switch. What I'm talking about. See, Tansen and I do this quite often where we just make stuff up. And, like, as long as it's believable, we're like...
No yeah. one disproves you, and you right? continue on.
Welcome to the
Freaky
podcast.
Freaky Friday is a body switch, not an aging
You're
overnight.
Right. You're totally right. See? Okay. So you called me on it.
I see, there's, like, legitimate... there still are, like, those gypsy crystal ball arcade games, though. So I just imagine those ones that, like, you can still go and see nowadays at carnivals and arcades and things.
Totally.
So I'm just imagining, like, although those ones is, like, generally, like, a male with, like, a 40-foot curled stash. It goes on and on right. and on.
I so. Do like the description for Madame Destiny, like, a mechanical, a group of boys trying to peer down her vertiginous cleavage.
Vertiginous. Such a good word.
Right?
I did look that up.
Yeah. To a slope that in... causes vertigo for being so steep.
Oh. Here I am thinking the word would be like bountiful or something.
Ample, yeah.
Ample, yeah. Oh, dear.
Her cleavage causes vertigo.
At least in the young boys trying to peer down her shirt.
Oh.
Yeah, the gypsy almost comes to life. They watch the mechanical gypsy hands move in a very realistic manner for wood or plaster, her fingers bending where no hinges were evident. The fortune on the card traumatizes one of the boys and they leave. And Cabal admonishes the gypsy and she raises a painted eyebrow. And I just love that. Like this sort of supernatural aspect to this carnival is so satisfying to me.
Yeah, no, he gets to interact with everything.
Mm-hmm. It's that part is very, very, very fun, honestly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like that it is all just like, yeah, Cabal's the boss, but
we can all be a little
fuck
cheeky
with this guy anyways. Yeah.
We can all be a little cheeky. We're made of magic stuff.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, technically they're owned by Satan, not Cabal. So
right. Yeah. Right.
And I was wondering about all the naming too of these characters, like the constructs, Mrs. Lentil, I had to look that up. It's a support beam, and Scree. Loose rocks, it means loose rocks,
yeah.
constructed the arcade. They loped around on stilt walkers in a low, overly thin legs, their equally long arms waving around. They wore black suits and dark glasses and hair of uncomfortable shade of yellow and thickness of darning wool. as Cabal watched them totter back and forth, barking at each other in an incomprehensible language of their own. Cabal had been confident that they were intended as gross parodies of himself, but refused to rise to the insult by saying as much.
the relationship of the Cabal brothers. Yes. Yeah, I love that they basically, well, at least Horse plays, you know, little tricks like that. It's sort of like a flipping the middle finger to his brother in a not so subtle but subtle way.
I didn't even think of Horse being the, because he was in charge.
So Horse created Lintel and Scree to create the, like, to construct the carnival as, like, gross parodies, and he made them gross parodies of Johannes.
So I didn't even catch that.
Hence
that
Johannes not wanting to stoop to making a comment, because it's like, so that's why I say the relationship between the brothers is just epic.
It's true.
It's
childishness, though. It's like, mommy's touching me, I'm not touching you, I'm not touching you.
Like, it's a sibling relationship through and through. Like playing pranks on each other, like mocking and like, haha, look, my Barbie looks like you, and like you cut the head off it or something. Shit we did to our younger siblings, you know.
Well, I find that interesting that later on that he does say that he warms to the two because they're so practical,
right?
But he wouldn't rise to the occasion of saying so.
Absolutely.
Which makes much more sense.
Totally.
Yeah. So there is like the fun, like, Madame Destiny conversations. I actually really like it a lot. Where they're just going back and forth.
Yes. And the card that she gives him, how it becomes like the compass. It reminded me a lot of like the Harry Potter, the, what is it? I do solemnly declare that I'm
the Marauder's
to no good.
Map.
That's it.
Yeah.
You know, in a way it starts acting like a compass.
Ink comes and goes. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, it's like Madame Destiny fucking with Cabal a little bit back and forth.
I like it though. It's cute.
As he describes that as a metamorphopsychosis.
Oh.
And then he actually puts a he actually has that little asterisk and at the end of the chapter describes it, which is a stage illusion that allows objects and persons to transform while in full sight of the audience, a variation of a more famous pepper ghost, so obscure that most magicians haven't even heard of it. Try mentioning it to any that you encounter, it baffles them.
I kind of want to find a magician now. Just be like,
hey you.
What do you know about the Pepper's ghost? Be like, what?
We'd love to torture people.
I'd be so impressed if it was like, oh, isn't that a Cabal reference?
It just instantly gives it.
Totally.
So, yeah, so it does, it, you know, behind you, ahead of you, go, go, go.
Yeah.
And leads him to Ted and Rachel.
Yes.
Yes.
Thanks, Madame Destiny. Yes. Which really, Destiny. Cabal found Ted and Rachel. How nice for him.
Voila. Yeah.
And I love just how sassy that the gypsy is, rolling her eyes at him as he spits out the card. Like, it can't actually sigh out loud, but it did.
I hope this is translating well between this glass.
And you see, cradles the fortune like a cardboard lodestone. I just love the way that that's described. Do you know what a lodestone is?
I don't.
A lodestone.
I think I've heard the use a few times.
Is a naturally magnetized piece of mineral magnetite. Oh. It's naturally occurring magnets. It's the first. They were the first magnetic compasses.
Oh.
Yeah. So he was using this card like a compass, but instead of saying like a compass, he grabbed it like a lodestone. It's just so much more interesting to me.
Hmm.
Even if I did have to stop what I was doing and read and actually have to look that up. Hear what the hell that all meant.
So Cabal encounters Ted and quite literally encounters him by bumping into him. And I like the, he knew Horst would probably regard running a rube through with a sword cane as poor public relations. But in Cabal's book, the customer is always right became academic the instant the customer drew back his fist. So, yeah, Ted's not reacting well to being bumped into. This, obviously, we know from meeting Rachel that Ted's a bit of a short fuse.
Short fuse, yeah. But I like that Madam's card is still working because, yeah, it's like, that's him, apologize. Yeah.
Apologize now.
This advice card is great. Never drop this, Cabal.
Right? I want a card
carry
like
this
that.
All the time, yeah.
Okay, should I turn left or right?
Yeah, right? Shake this hand, don't shake this hand.
Should I marry this person? Should I not?
Take this job, don't.
Exactly.
Yeah, but she's so sassy, she'd probably fuck with him, though.
Right?
He follows the advice, though.
Yeah. It's like those magic eight balls, like, you know, but better.
Right. I like it.
Right?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting about when he did bonk into him, that he's very analytical, like we've said before. The Cabal knew more than enough about the intricacies about the endocrine system to appreciate that a man that goes pale with anger is a great deal more likely to strike out than one that goes red.
Do you know, I thought about that. Like, that kind of makes sense, right? Like, all your blood goes to where it's needed the most, right? So if you're about to strike, all the blood goes away from the brain and straight into, like, the muscles that are going to require the movement.
I wondered about that. That makes more sense. Totally. I like that. Yeah. Thank you.
I like, though, that as soon as Cabal tells Ted, oh, hello, I'm the proprietor here, Ted instantly deflates to authority.
Right?
Like, damn, dude.
Which, actually, I like the fact that that reduced him in Cabal's mind. Like, it was just sort of like, oh, you know, like, it, a disappointment totally, that, like, the authority actually cows you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I agree, though. Like, there's certain times when, like, you shake someone's hand and it's so weak, no matter how they look, you're like, okay, seriously? Like,
right.
Really? Like, you do. You just, like, it's like, it's almost nothing, but you're still, like, no respect instantly. You're like, all right, bitch. Okay.
Makes that first impression.
So it's like, yeah, when you've got a guy who's just like, ooh, I'm going to punch you over. I see, oh, you're in charge. Hi. Don't kick me out of your carnival.
I'm sorry. Yeah, but see, like, there's the insecurity, right? Like, I mean, I don't know.
Again, I would respect him more if he continued to be like, I don't care who you are. But yeah, he's instantly just like, oh, okay. It's like, stick to your guns, dick.
Ted is a deeply troubled and insecure man.
Totally.
Yeah. Yes. But yes, cowed by authority.
So Cabal decides to placate Ted by offering him free vent or a stall. Rachel suggests shooting, where Ted admits to have shot her dog. That's so awful.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, actually, I really, I like the part Rachel attempts to calm Ted by saying that Cabal's not worth it. And I love this quote, Cabal, who at one time or another had been pursued by village mobs, town mobs, the police, the army, two inquisitions, and sundry other concerned citizens, was entirely positive that he was worth it.
Honestly, if the man wants to hit me, let him hit me.
Right? Like, no, seriously, I'm worth it. All these people who hate me can attest to it. You know,
haven't,
like,
seen my resume.
I got references. I got references from town mobs who would tell you I am worth the effort to try to kill.
I was gonna say, though, give it one more day and this entire carnival will be on your city's list.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. So, yes, then Cabal apologizes to Ted and is like, listen, I'll give you a staller exhibit in apology for this.
Right.
But yeah. So,
he likes to shoot things, says Rachel. I shot her dog, Ted responds. I put hashtag dark in my notes. Yes. Right?
So dark.
So Cabal takes the couple to the shooting range. And yeah, at this point, I like the comparison. Like, he talks about the shooting gallery rifles compared to his Webley revolver in his desk drawer. In return for the feat of striking down moving targets with ill-maintained rifles, the stall offered the chance to take home desperately ill goldfish, disconcerting Cupid dolls, decorative knickknacks of dubious quality and taste, and ill-proportioned baboons stuffed with kapok.
Like a true carnival.
Right? That pretty much summarizes it.
Just bullshit to take home.
Oh my god, that reminds me of a quote that I had earlier that I totally forgot about, which the when they were making that gallery with the shooting part. What was it here? Elsewhere, tin monkeys shinnied up palm trees. Ghosts appeared at the shadows of the haunted house, only to be met by a fusillade of shots in a shooting gallery. That makes no sense at all, Cabal Hood said. You can't exorcise ghosts with a rifle. I have some practical experience in this area, and it simply isn't going to work.
Symbolism is lost on Cabal. Yeah. It's like, wait, that's completely ludicrous.
See, that can't actually
shoot a ghost.
That line actually made me text my DM in D&D and be like, hey, my next character, I just want to be a ghost. Like, my goal is just to die and move on to the other side.
Right?
Because I said, I was like, you can still have me be shot with shit, but, like, I just want to, like, my whole goal to be death. Just going from that. I was like, yeah, I will be shot with a gun if I want to be.
Now, here's the question. As a ghost, see, now I'm thinking about what are the benefits to being a ghost? Ho, 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 foreshadowing to the next chapter. But the benefits of being a ghost, like, okay, why would you want to be a why would you want to be a ghost character?
Well, the it'd be up to the DM to decide what I would get out of it. But you know, he could decide that I can, you know, I have a faster speed than a normal human character would have.
But if you can't manipulate anything,
that real quick, when you play D&D, you have to choose a race, you have to choose a class, and right. Your class is whether or not you're like a fighter or a magic user or this or that, right? And a race is just whether or not you're a human or a dragon or a blah blah blah, right?
So you get like magic.
So I would just choose a class that helped in that way, because you don't want to like make it overpowered or something like that. So like between me and the DM, we'd both agree on whatever. But mostly I'd still be like a normal regular character. It'd just be flavor that I'm a ghost.
Oh, fascinating.
Cool.
But anyways.
So Ted gets 5 free shots to try to win something. And this is an opportunity for him to show off his excellent marksmanship.
I like that it says, too, that the sights have all been tampered with, so they don't work.
Which makes a lot of sense, because I have tried those shooter ones before, and it's like...
Oh, all those games are rigged.
I just ignore the sights on them and go, okay, there.
Yeah.
See, my favorite games are those water spray ones. I'm pretty sure those are completely off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those aren't consistent.
No.
Well, it's like those...
Rigged!
Those, like, glass bottle ones that you throw the rings on, and they're like, they sit in a mirrored... column, right? So they're not actually perfectly round bottles of Coke, but the mirror makes them look like they are. So that's why they bounce off so much, because they're more like squares or triangles or whatever like that.
Oh, that's why lies.
I know, right?
Do you know, I also heard that the way that they, you know, when you throw the ball into the apple barrel or bucket?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So basically the width of the bucket, like it looks super easy. Like, yeah. Why couldn't I? But the ball always bounces back out because they round the bottom. So like it totally when it hits, like that
comes out the barrel.
Yeah, the convex.
That's so funny.
Bounces it out.
You've got to have just the perfect amount that it doesn't bounce once it lands.
Yeah.
Fuck.
See, all these games are rigged.
Oh, yeah, they all are. Carnival games are fully.
Wow.
Yeah.
Reminds me of when I did work for like an online casino company. And I started looking into like those one-armed bandit.
Online Poker Stars or
yeah, whatever, like the one-armed bandit games and whatnot. And it's like, they are ultimately rigged. But like the way that the psychology works, you think you've won something. We were just talking about this morning with like the McDonald's Monopoly games, where it's like you go, oh my God, I just won $1,000. Oh no, that's like $1,000 if you collect 3 of these.
It's like, yeah, it's like a chance to win $1,000. Now enter all your information on our site, and you and everyone else who got this ticket will also now be pulled from in a draw and then add to another draw, and then now that pool will be pulled from a draw. Yeah.
Now we've got a list of customers we can spam the hell out of and try other gimmicks and whatnot.
That's like the thing with like Tim Hortons Roll the Rim.
Yeah.
If you don't keep the entire cup, they don't have to honor it for you.
Are you serious?
So if you rip out the small little piece, yeah. So for accepting donuts or coffee, they don't care, right? But if you try and go claim a car and you don't have the full cup intact, they'll be like, sorry, this isn't legitimate.
Oh, wow. Things to know. Yep. Things to know. But yes, with the one-armed bandit, essentially it's like the psychology works where, okay, so you put in $1 and it says, you won 25 cents. Well, no, actually you lost 75 cents. Right?
Yeah.
But theoretically, you're getting excited because you just won 25 cents.
Yeah.
But how is it you can't make the next move, right? Yeah. So I did all this research when I was working for them, and I thought that was really fascinating. And it is something like less than 20% returns on.
Ooh.
Yeah. I can't. Again, I'm BSing out my ass, but like, you know, it's not good winnings on those things.
Normally. House always wins.
Right? But yeah, I do know people who've won some pretty big money on it, but. Yeah, that's after how many years of losing?
Yeah.
Mm.
It's like the stock markets. I always remember my big gains and just, we'll just ignore all the money I lost. Yeah.
It's fine. But luckily, Ted's not paying this time.
Right.
Legitimately 5 free games.
Yeah.
And yes, broken sight or not, Ted is a good shot.
Yes, and Cabal is disappointed. Instead of something nefarious happening, he was looking at an oaf doing quite well for himself in an egotistical show of physical superiority. He might as well have been watching professional sports. Okay, loved that part. What you got to say, Jess?
I like how this causes Cabal to start fucking being like a mime with the proprietor. Be like, fuck this shit up. Like, this is your job now. Like, what, the carnival's supposed to like step in and fix this. And he's like miming to the proprietor
of the stall holder.
And yeah. The guy's like, what the fuck are you doing? And he's like, just make with the Satan magic. And he's like, what? And he's like, it's just the thing. Like, he's winning. What the fuck? And he's like, huh?
Make it happen. Bring out the contract.
It's just so out of Cabal. I'm like, you idiot. Like, he's just dancing around basically like, he made a gesture. That gesture didn't work. He tried a different gesture. That gesture also didn't work. He was running out of gestures.
Horse says, what are you doing? I'm gesturing.
It's very good.
It's very good gesturing.
Thank you, brother.
But that's the thing. It's really interesting because like it referred at one point in the chapter that like this was sort of their first victim. And like, not really.
Legitimately by the carnival.
By the carnival. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because it's sort of like, it reminds me of opening day on like, any new project or any, you know, launching thing. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like nobody really knows what we're supposed to do, right?
Yeah.
It's the first day of the job for everyone. And you're like, okay, is this your job to collect the signature or is it my job? Right? And so you asked earlier, you said about Horst, you know, how he basically said, okay, I found a victim, but didn't really tell anything more. And so I wonder, like going through this, the chapter, it's like, well, does Horse never really wanted to get involved anyway,
mm-hmm.
right? So in the same way, it's like you got this stall holder going, okay, I'm here to do your bidding, but like I don't understand what I'm supposed to do. Like to a certain degree, it is, the onus is on Cabal to collect these signatures.
Yeah.
It's not Horst's job. He doesn't want anything to do with it as far as possible. It's not the stall holder's job because, well, he's just there to entertain the crowds and you know, carry on the carnival as semi-nefariously as possible.
It is a little bit of a funny line, though, to see, like, how much of the carnival works for itself and how much the carnival is like, bitch, this is your carnival. Do your job, Cabal.
Right.
And Cabal keeps expecting the carnival to roll out the red carpet and do its job. And then every once in a while, it comes up short and they're like, no, now it's your turn. He's like, ah, fuck.
But like,
you're
what
short
is the
one
job?
Barker. What? Nobody knows who's getting the signatures. It's like just a little bit, just like
a little off.
All your furniture has been moved 1 inch over. And you're like, something is wrong. This is mostly right, but something is off. Like,
do you know a friend of mine once practical joked me that way?
You see, it's effective.
They found out my locker combo and they took, like, this was back in high school, and they took all the stuff out of my locker, moved it like 4 stalls over to like an empty locker and replaced every single thing in exactly the way that I had it. And so, like, I open my locker and it's empty. I'm like, what the hell? And so I'm trying to figure things out. Like, this is the morning that I get to school. Like, trying to figure it out.
And then
I thought, wait a sec, that locker 4 down was never locked. Like, it was always open, but now it's got a lock on it. So, walked over, opened it. Lo and behold, everything that I owned was in perfect condition. I was like, that's a pretty damn good
joke. That's a pretty good joke.
You know? But, like, that's essentially what the carnival is here. It's like everything's a little off, or it seems on the up and up, but something's not quite right, as you say.
Right through the cracks.
Right.
So, so it's funny, though, that even for Cabal, you know, who should be, you know, the proprietor, he should be aware of the cracks, that even he is, like, looking at these and being like, the fuck? Like,
feels like every management job I've ever had.
Yeah, fair enough. And again, opening night, there's only so much you can prepare for. You never know what the realities are going to be until you're in the middle of it. But, yeah.
Totally.
So, yes. And I also like, though, that we just had this conversation. Horse is like, hey, you found them, right? And so was he stalking them the whole time, too? Was he this invisible presence following Cabal and Ted and Rachel? Or was he also just, like, out of nowhere and then appeared again? Like,
you talking Horse?
Yeah, Horse. He might have been following them this whole time at a distance, invisible, whichever it was.
Stealth.
The
vampire who watches.
Or if he was like in the middle of like some spider wars and he watched him walk by, he's like, oh shit, this again.
Snack time.
Yeah. Stop for just one quick moment of entertainment. Horse deserves a break too.
Absolutely.
So Horse breezes off to get a top prize, a doll, one that winks. He suggests sticking a jigger of diabolical influence in it. And just for those who are not familiar with a jigger,
what does that mean?
It's a bartending term. It's about an ounce, an ounce and a half. It's like for doing shots.
Ooh.
So you use it to measure your drinks.
See, I thought it was something much more magical than that. But I guess for people who like alcohol, that is kind of magical.
Yeah.
And see, this is Horse getting involved.
Fact.
Yeah. Johannes imbues it with influence and Horst quickly puts the prize in the stall with nobody noticing.
Well, until Rachel notices the doll.
Yes.
And yes, Horst, I love this interaction. It's like classic sales technique
where
Horst pretends to be interested in the doll and then uses that psychology to trigger Ted's competitiveness.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I like the point. He cared a lot about ownership, though, in reference to Ted. Right. So, like, that's what I was saying earlier in terms of, like, the ownership of Rachel. Like, we see a little later into the chapter that, yeah, he likes to break his toys.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. Own the toys and break them. Right.
I like, too, that both Ted and Cabal brush off that psychology. They're both like, yeah, fuck you. Both of them have their own reasons, but they're both like, shut up, Horst. Right.
But, like, I've done that. Gosh, I remember having to do that with my mother when I was, like, an adult. Like, she was a salesperson. If I came in, like, she taught me how to do that. Yeah. And, like, when she owned her own business, where it was like, if she had a customer, I could walk over and be like, wow, this is a really nice thing. You know, whatever it was that was being sold. And people would be like, oh.
Fucking scammer.
Right? I was a childhood scammer. This should be my next biography.
There you go. Yeah. Your next career path.
Well, I could tell a few more stories on that front, but, you know, all truth all the time here, folks.
Mm-hmm. Unless the cops are listening.
Unless I'm balderdashing. Right, yeah. If you don't believe me, just ask me.
So, yeah, I do like that Cabal is like, Horst, you're helping. Why the fuck are you? And Horst is like, huh? What? Bye.
Yeah, he totally disappeared mid-sentence.
Well, Johannes,
I agree with that.
Yeah. I like it. But Ted takes the doll and Rachel and Ted go off into the night. Cool. And I like, too, that even Cabal is like, I don't know what the fuck I just did. Horst made me do this and I don't see why. But he's like, okay, I guess I'm done now. Like,
right. So Horst disappears. Cabal returns to the house of medical monstrosity.
But like, even like that Satan's blood, it just does what it wants. And even like, you know, no one else knows how it's going to manifest itself. Just same as the carnival. It's like sometimes it works and sometimes it does its own thing.
Well, you know. Can't expect predictability out of Satan, really.
It's fair.
Predictably unpredictable.
Yeah. I mean, the guy likes to...
Prince of Darkness, you know.
Be creative.
Lord of all underrealm. You know, not exactly known for his consistency.
Nah, like. You know. Take.
So, Rachel gets the doll, and we get more insight into the battered woman, reasoning and responses. Right. One of the quotes, weighing against this uncritical appreciation of any small kindness he might show her, such as not hitting her, not spitting on her, or not groping her best friend while in her sight, was the distinct sense that there was something not right about the doll itself.
Well, and she really makes excuses for him. Like, she just hits home of the abusive nature of their relationship.
Absolutely.
Rachel is aware of the wrongness of the doll and how it feels, the fact that it pricks her somehow and it shows its toothy smile. Yeah, she drops the doll and Ted picks it up. Ted squeezes the doll, expecting something to poke him, but he experiences satisfaction instead of a sharp object.
He's suddenly enamored with the doll.
And JLH starts, instead of using it pronouns for the doll, starts using she pronouns at this point in time.
So it does take on a life at this point for...
She feels warm and soft and curvy.
Right.
Begins to talk to Ted.
Yes. Discussions with the dolls. Interesting, the doll starts negating Rachel. Like, tells Ted that she could love him better. And the quote, loyalty, that was one thing, but love. So Ted finds his attraction to Rachel waning in light of having this...
Trixie
mm-hmm. in his arms.
We also get some really lovely side descriptions through this chapter. I quoted this one because it just sounded so good to me. He paused in the shadow of Helter Skelter, the delighted screams of the children rolling off him, they swept around and down the side. He had half-formed impressions of the screams carrying on beneath ground level and seeming much less delighted. Like, what an interesting way to put that hellish atmosphere into this carnival. Like, he thinks he's hearing things, but he probably is actually hearing the reality of this hellish carnival, like the screams of horror underneath in hell.
Right.
I love it. I love it so much.
You're a dark.
The bridge
dark
between is so thin.
Right. So
I even like I mean, it's not just even the doll dismissing Rachel, but, like, as the chapter goes on, like, Ted starts forgetting who she is, too. Like, who's that girl again? Like, what's her name? What was it? Either way, she's annoying me. I'm trying to have a conversation with Trixie here.
Yeah. Totally. Right? And we get into more of that sort of descriptive, you know, like, now when Ted's squeezing Trixie, now he imagined squeezing Rachel, squeezing any real woman like that. Imagined all the sharp wires of their lives and history, of their desires and thoughts. Unwanted, unnecessary, stabbing into his hands as he squeezed, the blood coming from his wounds, staining their dresses red. That, to me, I was like, holy shit. That's a really powerful, like, I don't know, my brain
very
went
dark,
on.
Very dark, very harsh.
My brain went on some interesting tangents with that one, just like the whole, like, the history and the wires, that was it, like, the wires of, the sharp wires of their lives and histories, their desires and thoughts, like, JLH is a feminist. He's got to be.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I saw it as a little bit of a foreshadowing to what their relationship would have ended had this not occurred.
Yeah.
Like that she would have been eventually killed by the man.
Broken pieces of wires.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, very dark.
Yep. And it all comes to a coalescent when Ted suddenly finds himself on the wrong side of the carnival gates.
Yes.
And it all goes away.
He loses the Trixie feeling.
No more. Yes.
Absolutely.
Just a grown man in his doll.
And so Ted sees Cabal waiting, and Cabal pulls out the contract. And, yeah, essentially Cabal returns with the signed contract to Horst in the office on the train. And this is their first official victim.
I just want to throw in, though, that they make him pay to re-enter the carnival, though, to sign away his soul.
You've had to pay once, so you're going to pay again.
Hey, no re-entry.
You're gonna pay for
no re-entry. I've been yelled just at like for that at the salt, Stampede.
Salt on the wound. We're about to take your soul, but another $5, bitch.
Yeah. You know, to get back the Trixie feeling.
Yeah. Which is, yeah, worth it to Ted.
Oh,
he
yeah.
He goes in, he signs that contract, and he's happy forever.
Yes. And their first official victim.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That the...
It's even funnier, too, that Ted wants a job. Like, he's come to be like, how do I be a part of this? And they're like, well, listen, can't work here. Sign this form, though. It'll all be okay.
Yeah.
And yeah, and it's very much just like, the Cabal Brothers Carnival thanks you for your interest.
Well, and I like the fact that, like, even just Johannes mentioning the job, like, Ted hadn't considered it. So it's like, he's obviously got, like, you know, pretty high persuasive skills, Johannes does.
I think, you know, Ted is also just a little bit floaty right now, you know? Like, he's just very easily persuaded at this moment if it means keeping Trixie.
He's lost that love and feeling. Whoa, that love and feeling.
Yeah, I did like that he uses that big giant word, the agomatophilia. Had to look that up too, just to make sure. But
yeah.
It's a paraphilia involving sexual attraction to statue, doll, mannequin, or other similarly figurative object.
Yes.
But he uses again once Horst and Johannes are back in the office, and they're discussing the events. He uses
the paraphilia
term, and Horse is like, what? Thank God somebody else doesn't know what he's talking about. We at least have the fortune of dictionaries,
right?
Poor Horst.
And the internet.
Yes.
Yeah. Don't it's look true, it up though. Don't look it up
when you're dealing with this
don't look up the images anyway. Wikipedia is fine.
So Horst and Johannes are back in the office discussing events. Johannes specifically wants to do exposition on how diabolical influence works.
Diabolical influence?
Yeah. How does those work? Like, he wanted to know about, like, did he already have attraction to dolls, or did the carnival implant the attraction to this doll, or?
Oh, yes, the paraphilia.
Yeah.
Yes. I like this conversation with them, too, and I like the quote, given my profession, being careful is what separates the success from the failures. Both Cabal and Horst were surprised at the ease of getting signatures. And I like that Cabal's measure of personal success. He says, because I'm not tied to a post up to my knees in a bonfire. I think that should be my personal measure of success as well.
Right.
You know, if I'm not up to my knees in a bonfire, it's a good day.
You're doing well. You're doing real well.
It's a good day.
Johannes reissues his question to Horst to why he's helping him.
Yes. And Horst noted that Rachel's makeup was to cover the black eye from Ted. And the quote, "I could smell the violence on him even through his cheap aftershave. I know his sort. One day he would do something a great deal worse. I decided he needed to be stopped."
And for me, this was very interesting because I didn't realize that Cabal hadn't picked up on it either at this point. Because Cabal's like, "Oh, really? Like, she was covering a black eye? Like, I didn't notice that at all." And for me, like, I was like, "How could you not have, Cabal?" Like, and I get like, but yeah, like, when you think about it from Cabal's point of view, like, a piece of paper told him, "Ted, your victim." That's all. He didn't question it after that, you know? He didn't need a reason more. Ted was like, "Sure, paper says this guy, done. Madame Destiny said this guy, no more needed, necessary."
Well, I think their original intro of, like, Ted being quick to anger, it's sort of like, okay, this is obviously the victim. I don't know how much attention he was actually paying to Rachel, right? Yeah. It's sort of like she was the side.
For me, this was just, yeah, my first indication bag. That, yeah, Cabal was like, just, yeah, Ted totally disregarded Rachel from the beginning.
Yeah.
This is not my victim. I do not care.
Well, and being as diminutive as she, you know, is described to be, true, like, yeah, she fades into the background, probably just. Yep.
Safety.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Johannes tells him, "Well, now that you've told me your motives for helping me to get this signed, it's taken the shine off of it somewhat. We're supposed to be doing this the devil's work, and you've gone and contaminated it with a whiff of virtue."
Damn that virtue.
"I really don't think you've got the hang of being an agent of evil."
I really like that.
"Early days yet, Johannes."
Practice
stood up and stretched. Practice makes perfect.
Yeah. Early days. Yeah. Yes.
Chapter concludes with a description of Satan's blood and a mathematical calculation for the volume of the ball.
Right. Yeah, I like how it just keeps us updated on that.
Yes. For those of you that were curious.
Yes. Those of you keeping track, here's how much blood he used for that.
This concludes our episode 3.5, That's Psychology. Thanks for listening. You can find us online at freeflowrambling.com and necromancers.ca. There we have links to our other podcasts, social media, and other fun tidbits. Please subscribe if you like what you're hearing, and please consider supporting us through Patreon to keep the undead alive and to see more content. We are Free Flow Rambling, and remember, reanimation is trending.